Hello everyone, James here from the 1D4Cast podcast. Our convention 1D4Con returns to provide lots of gaming fun to the Northern Shenandoah Valley region for a sixth year, happening April 13th through 15th. We will be at the Holiday Inn of Martinsburg, West Virginia again, which means there is a lot of space for tabletop RPGs, LARPs, board games, and miniatures game. D&D Adventures League and Pathfinder Society are planning to have a huge presence again this year, but we also have plenty of other traditional and indie RPGs for you to enjoy. This year, we will also be providing a miniatures paint and take sponsored by FLGS Your Hobby Place of Martinsburg. Our charity for this year is Extra Life, and there are a variety of ways that you can donate, including participation in our Games of Charity Boons for designated games, playing charity-marked games that cost a couple dollars over the badge fee to play, as well as charity raffles with awesome gaming items donated by a variety of sources. Pre-registration is now open until March 31st through tabletop.events. Those who pre-register have early access to sign up for all posted games and the ability to purchase shirts until March 15th. Join us for a fun-filled weekend of gaming greatness in the beautiful Shenandoah Valley. Find out more at 1d4con.com.
Welcome to Season 10, Episode 4 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we talk a little bit about the classic movie monsters and their place in, well, your average role-playing game. Again, welcome to Season 10, Episode 4 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this week is Chris. Welcome.
Howdy, howdy.
Unfortunately, Paul had some scheduling conflict, so he was not going to be able to talk to us this week. I'm sad. But we will soldier on and get through it, I think. What do you think?
I think we will do our best.
All right. So this one was just kind of a weird one we just kind of threw together here. And it was, I don't know how it all started, but someone said something, and the only thing I could think of, there was some talk about Valentine's Day, and then I kind of joked that, you know, when I think of Valentine's Day and monsters, the only thing I can think of is, you know, the classic movie monsters of, like, Dracula and Frankenstein's monster or the mummy. You know, they're all just looking for love.
Yep. All the wrong places.
That's the way that goes sometimes. But, of course, that was just the classic Hollywoodism, I guess, you know, of the time.
Oh, indeed.
I don't have any other really news this week. Do you?
Not really. Nothing, yeah. I can come to mind at this point.
You know, I think I've said it before, and unless it's something spectacular, I find most of the press releases for products boring. Does that make any... You know, it's like, I mean, you know, people are like, well, you know, you could cover what Pathfinder or, you know, what Paizo or WotC's releasing. Yeah. I mean, I'm not that that's not interesting, but half the time I'm just not excited by them.
Well, that's kind of true here. I think we're at the point of gaming where if we don't already have it, it really has to grab us. Like, I think the last game that really knocked our socks off was got to be Flash Gordon, and that was back in December. So,
right, and then of course, as I've said before, the Kickstarters have just, I mean, even established companies are using Kickstarters to even bother to see if a product's worth even messing with these days.
Yeah.
It's like a weird judge. We really do live in a very different world than, you know, we lived in 20 years ago in terms of that.
Oh, agreed.
So, I mean, I remember the day when basically you couldn't get a D&D product on PDF because, no, we don't want to do PDFs. And, well, now we do again.
Oh, definitely. And again, we're living in an era where you're not just competing with your contemporaries.
Right.
You're competing with the past.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've talked about, you know, the rule cyclopedia a couple of times, and lo and behold, guess what? You can get a version printed on demand now through DriveThruRPG. So, hey. And I think that's it. It's like, you know, when you get a nice soft cover version, I guess, now. You don't have to get a hard cover if you don't want to.
Yeah. Like, I guess this really isn't news, but it's kind of fun. Just recently, the GM's drive-thru decided to finally release as a print-on-demand product the original DD Cyclopedia that came out in the early 90s. So
yeah, that's what I was talking about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
You're behind the power curve.
Yes, I think I'm a little tired, but that's okay.
That's okay. We'll make for a fun episode.
Absolutely.
So why don't we just go ahead and slay the big monsters in the room, which is, you know, let's face it, the classic movie monsters. I know I'm going to show my age, and people are going to be like, you're lame. Those are so... But I grew up in an era that, you know, obviously the 30s and 40s and 50s movie monsters, you know, when I was growing up as a kid, you know, I'm talking, you know, mid to late 70s, early 80s. I mean, let's face it, Star Wars was just... I mean, it was a big hit in the 70s, but that whole even concept of the way science fiction was at that point was vastly different. I mean, you see you watch science fiction movies that were earlier in period of time, and then you mm-hmm. see Star Wars, and you're just like, wow, that's like night and day.
Oh, absolutely. Like a lot, well, at the risk of going off a side tangent, 70s sci-fi up to about Star Wars was trying to play around with complex thoughts and seeing what stuck to it. Or was they, you know, they went for the really kind of boring, long sci-fis. They usually question what if.
Right.
Whereas Star Wars was a throwback to Flash Gordon. You know, it was basically two-fisted pulp action, just reskinned and remodified for his own things. So it had a different element when it came down to it here. But I guess let's begin the Monster Mash.
Yeah, the Monster Mash. I wish I had that. That would be a great song for this, an intro for this, but I'm not going to go looking for it. It's not worth it that much.
Agreed.
But no, I mean, it's interesting. And you know, it's funny, though, because you know Guy Gax, especially for D&D, he was definitely a fan of these. And don't get me wrong, it's not like, I mean, let's face it. In D&D, of course, we have vampires. Of course, you know, we have werewolves of some sort. You have various mummies and, you know, when you look at Frankenstein, that's a flesh golem by any other name. You know, Frankenstein's monster was a flesh golem. And then, you know, you listed the creature from the Black Lagoon, and I mean, there's probably, you could argue, was that the creature from the Black Lagoon, or was that an H.P. Lovecraft influence? Your choice, you decide.
Yeah.
And it might have been a little bit of each.
Yeah. Well, I always thought of the creature of the Black Lagoon was basically a single solitary episode of Sasquin from D&D, but that's just a guess. You know, all the shark people there down there.
Oh, yeah, maybe. You know, again, it's so hard to tell, but I think those classic movies definitely did have an impact on gaming. I mean, because it's like, you know, you couldn't almost not think of having those monsters early on. And I sometimes wonder whether or not they've become. How do we put this? I don't know. Like, too boring for the modern taste or something?
Well, when you're the trendsetter that sets everything up, everybody rips you off, and then what made you original change, you know, basically becomes boring. Like, the original Frankenstein is the reason we associate Frankenstein with electricity.
Oh.
You know, those really cool Tesla coils or those balls with the static electrical charge back in the day.
Oh, with the little... But it's not the Jake... Those weird antennae things with the little, you know, electrical arcing through them.
But Jacob's Ladder? Or...
Is that what that Sorry. Is? That's what I wanted to say, but I'm not sure what it actually is. But yeah.
Okay. Well.
You know, and let's face it, you don't get movies like, well, Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Without that. And, you know, all the fun that's and stupidity that's associated with that. But, I mean, you know, but even, I mean, let's just take, start with Frankenstein. You mentioned electricity. I mean, I don't know. It's one of the, I think, is it the earliest flesh golem? It's, I think, first edition. Was that right? I don't know. Well, or was one of the later editions that mentioned it, too, where it's like, you know, lightning, like, heals them.
Or something. Yeah.
It's like, okay. You know, I mean, that's a definite... hold, you know, trope connection from that, you know. Well, and of course there is the source material.
Yeah. You know. Well, again, Mary Shelley's is sometimes argued to be the single first sci-fi novel because of some of the elements it brought up from previous elements. Some other podcasts already did a really good analysis of this, But the basic Coles Notes version is they ripped off everything from Paradise Lost to the brutal, what was it, the brutal tragedy of Baron something or another, some German book, and how it mixed in some elements of both in order to build a new character. Plus, it's the new Prometheus, which takes off Greek, you know, the Greek aspects. What happens when man starts getting elements they should not no longer have, which is a very heavy element in a lot of horror. You did that. Why'd you do that? And how this happened?
Well, I mean, and it can, hell, I think even a lot of the early science fiction, I mean, movies, you know, you're looking 1950s, you know, what was man not meant to do or know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, don't get me started. I could talk on for hours about, you know, atomic horror concepts.
Well,
and
that's it. I mean, and then you roll that into the, you know, all the atomic horror stuff that went on, and it was just, it gets a little, I won't say dicey, but it gets a little.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how to put that, really, well, into words.
Well, Frankenstein, ultimately, and besides the fact that a lot of this, you know, later versions were less smart, they're basically, you know, like you said, golems. You could argue that Eve is the first organic robot in a lot of ways. You know, like, if you keep drawing some elements like Ruhr and so forth.
Yeah, well,
you know, in that aspect here. Like, unfortunately, as soon as you start being able to build, you know, golems, the good guys want them as much as the bad guys. Because, you know, you build yourself a golem, you send him in the front lines, and he takes the hit so you don't have to if you're doing a more conventional dungeon hack.
Right.
You know, heck. Or he could be the, you could use him like a puzzle. You know, I got to wake up this beast because he has some exciting information, but he's basically dead. And then we have a whole bunch of dials we got to play with in order to either wake him up or keep him down, depending on what sort of story you're trying to say. Also, Frankenstein's often considered the most sympathetic of all the classic Universal monsters. Hands down, because he's often presented as a simpleton. Or somewhat likable, despite the book showing he was just kind of vindictive.
Yeah.
And kind of a representation of humanity, both the good and the bad.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think the movies usually have tried to portray him as, if not a simpleton, more like someone who's ignorant of what really is going on.
Yeah.
You know, I really wouldn't say he's simple. A lot of times they present him as someone who doesn't quite understand what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like he doesn't have the, you know, it's like a baby growing up in a, you know, a 7-foot
yeah.
body that's like, oh, I don't know, I pushed it. I'm strong enough that I can bend metal and I crush something without even realizing it.
Yeah, and that's actually kind of terrifying. Think about a baby with the personality in the body of essentially an ogre.
Right.
That's a terrifying combination because you basically have to play nice and hope he doesn't break your local facilities because of it. You know, the last thing you want to do is be involved in a temper tantrum with that.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, I mean, a lot of, I think this is the problem. It's like a lot, and I mean, it's not just the classic movie monsters, you know, that have this, but I think a lot of times, I know I've been guilty of it where, you know, you're right, these creatures who, doesn't matter which one you pick, but we're going to start throwing. We're obviously doing Frankenstein first. It's kind of weird where they almost just become a weird stat block, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a mistake that we do with a lot of monsters. And I'm not saying that all monsters need to have personalities or goals or whatever, but it's like, you know, you... And I think that's why sometimes I think when I'm using these monsters, I see them used, they don't live up to hype that's in my head.
No, that makes perfect sense,
you know,
because a lot of it, you just have to, you almost have to give it its own spin, because almost everybody's familiar with these critters, at least on the subconscious level.
Right, and I mean, you know, and I think that's, you know, you, and I'm not, and it's not like I've seen them played like, you know, a whole bunch of flesh golems that act more like, you know, the Frankenstein that we see in movies, but I don't know. It's weird because, you know, you almost would hope that at least one of them would have those some of those aspects. You know, it's like you were talking more along the lines of using them as an adventure idea.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I do agree. I mean, it's weird how that just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So much.
And again, Frankenstein is the pitch-perfect creature for a necromancer. You stitch together the parts, you build your life, you bring life to it, but it's a cruel parody of life, depending on who you're talking about. Hell, in some versions, they argue that he doesn't even have a soul, despite being very much alive. And if you start going to metaphysical concepts and places where, let's be honest, D&D, you can't be an atheist. If you don't have a soul in that environment, what the hell are you for? And you can explore some really interesting concepts. In fact, what I would probably do, I would just take a human or whatever race you're animating and kind of put it as color text. Hi, I came back from the dead. I have the same stats as everybody else, but I was animated rather than born. Hmm. And suddenly you got a really unique PC that doesn't break your rules.
That is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would actually make it for a very interesting, I don't know, almost like, not obviously not all the players can be could be Frankenstein, but it would make for an interesting one shot.
Absolutely.
You know. Huh.
And because of that, you can just sort of explain stuff. Like, it's not like it hasn't been used before, the basic concept. Like, one of my favorite book series from the 80s from D&D is, of course, the Firestone Trilogy, where the main character was essentially a magical version of Frankenstein. He was a similar Onkron that was created due to extreme tattoo magic and was never born and was used to wake up a god of corruption because of their unique background. And if you build your characters to have really interesting plot twists that don't change too much of the mechanics of the game, you'd be surprised where it takes you.
Well, you know, and I think that's one of the interesting things that people forget. You know, I mean, I'm always, you know, it's like I look at D&D or any fantasy game, and you look at humans, and then you look at the fantasy races, and I always do sometimes wonder if some of the fantasy races have too many powers.
Yeah.
You know, you're just like, and people argue, well, you know, that's why, you know, humans get these other special abilities. You know, like, obviously in 5th edition, 4th edition, 3.5, you know, they get the extra feats or something like that for free. And I'm like, well, you know, that's interesting. But I don't know if that ever really counterbalances, you know, the whole concept of some of their, you know, races. And it's like, you know, I don't know. I sometimes think I think it's always been a case sometimes that, especially with playable fantasy races, we give them a little too much love.
Well, it's an easy concept. Well, no, we went through a huge period where basically we keep flipping back and forth when it comes to normal and abnormal characters. And I would argue that D&D is actually one of the worst systems to try to play classic Hollywood monsters. Like, you know, you might almost want to play a more horror-based game. Like, I don't know, we always talk about Dread and the Jenga Tower of Doom, but that's going to cause nerve tension on a whole different level because of it. Or a game where if you do the classic horror movie tropes, you actually get bonuses for it, even if it's just for somebody else. Like, you split up the party, you go up into the attic. You know, because otherwise it ends up being, okay, we're using the buddy system. We're watching each other's backs. We're making sure we're well-armed. We know our enemy because everybody knows your enemy. Like, you know, I guess as a transition, we can go to the one that basically started the whole thing off, Dracula. How many people, you know, it was such an original monster back in the day, but
well,
it's 50 years later. And
well, you know, but
unless you pull a certain twist on it, you got a rough idea what you're up against.
Yeah, but Dracula's kind of a weird one in this list because there's a whole legend of Dracula that kind of predates even the appearance, you know. You know, I mean, at least certain aspects of him were based on people's perceptions of an actual person.
Oh, absolutely. Like, Vlad Tepes is probably one of the most I find him actually a lot more terrifying than actually the character that Dracula is based on, because, well, he really existed and he was a monster in every sense of the word.
Although the irony to him to be a complete monster, he actually had a pretty he was really big on having people be public servants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, I he had an actual whole civil bureaucracy, which he was one of the first, his kingdom was one of the first kingdoms that actually had a very huge civil bureaucracy to run things.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, you know, for the time.
Well, definitely. And it was also a bit of, you know, I guess diversification of power and so forth. And
oh, of course, you know, because you're divesting your mm-hmm. nobility that you don't really like and placing that power with people that, well, I can kill them and replace them later if I don't like what they do.
Yeah. But if we're going to go into vampire tales, like, the basic concept of something that steals energy or blood, for lack of a better term, you could talk about the Lamias of Greece, you could talk about Lilith of the Babylonians and that era. And just the concept of the, I guess, ultimately, vampires are the personification of sex is bad, okay? Or sexual transmitted disease, when you think about it. You know, I think it's a lot of ways we used to keep you in the scared and the straight and narrow. However, some of the original vampire tales were actually just more like roaming packs of monsters. You know, like, you didn't stretch too far because the thing would come up and eat you, for lack of a better term. It wasn't until the Romantic moment that we started adding a lot more elements there, and oddly enough, Dracula wasn't even the first one. I remember something about Varney the vampire, not the dinosaur. Let's make sure we don't confuse the two. That would just be scary.
Varney the dinosaur is a vampire. Now that would be interesting.
He does love you. Oh, wait.
Okay.
I'm sorry. That took us to a silly place, but continue.
Oh, yeah. Well, again, World of Darkness, that's the thing that launched the 1000 franchise, and the first real competitor to TSR back in the day is the concept of playing the bad guy, the vampire. And not only do they figure out how to live off humanity, they actually have been well organized for thousands of years. And when you compare it to something like D&D, where they didn't even get their bite attack until like 4th edition. Before, you used to have a level drain and a slam attack, which is just weird.
Well, I think a lot of it just had to do with they weren't quite sure how they wanted to represent it. So it was just kind of a weird, you know, mm-hmm. here, we'll represent that. I think so many things were dealt with like a energy drain touch of some sort,
mm-hmm.
you know, or, you know, the ghouls had their paralysis touch or whatever. It was just like, let's just do this. That'll be easier.
Yeah. And again, if you want to go for a very simple way to get influence a character within a thing here, have your character start with his, for lack of a better term, one unique thing. He's already been bitten, but he's not a vampire yet. Thus creating a connection to the big bad. You know, if you're going to play the vampire as the villain, like one of my favorite, you know, video games when I was younger was, of course, Castlevania.
Mm.
Even though it basically just threw everything in a monster blender, which actually, if anything, it's almost the successor during that period to the Universal Monsters because of all the different monsters they used within the franchise, as well as creating a whole bunch on their own. Yeah. And, of course, we can't talk about D&D vampires without talking about Strahd.
Yeah, well, obviously Ravenloft. I mean, I know some people that have, I mean, how many versions of Ravenloft have they done? Besides the original D&D adventure, AD&D adventure that was put out, and, you know, they have campaign settings, and, I mean, they made a campaign setting pretty much for what, ever since 3, 4, and 5?
Yeah. Well, first edition had the original Dragon thing. Second edition, they did an entire world. They definitely played it red. Mm. Third edition was outsourced out to Swords and Sorcery, the guys that did World of Darkness. Fourth edition was a board game. And oddly enough, fifth edition was the first world they did after Forgotten Realms. So they actually did Ravenloft as their big meta module for a year. So, and they basically just expanded on the original module. They even got the Hickmans back to write it. So that's actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
And like, what about yourself, man? Like any games that you specifically have used vampires in?
You know, I've actually always been a little shy about using vampires in games. And I think a lot of it has to do with especially once Ravenloft was out, it almost, it's like, you know, there was the issue of Ravenloft existing in a way. There was, and in many ways, I mean, especially with D&D and stuff, it's like, especially once, you know, like you have the, you know, like you mentioned World of Darkness and how, you know, obviously a Vampire the Masquerade that came out, and it's almost become passé to use a vampire for anything.
You know? Yeah.
You're just like, oh, it's a vampire. Oh, this should be boring. I mean, it almost, you almost have that feeling, you know. I mean, although very people are very passionate about Ravenloft and Strahd, mm-hmm. and I'm like, well, that's great. I'm glad that you have that connection and that fear or whatever you want to call it. But mostly I've never really used vampires. You know, obviously flesh golems, I like. I think for me, a lot of times, it's what I can see as the humanity of a creature that draws me.
Yeah.
There's just nothing. There's nothing that draws me to vampires at all.
No.
You know, it's like, you know, I mean, and you figure, like I said, I mean, I'd almost, at this point, I think vampires have become oddly overused. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you think, like I said, you have World of Darkness, you have, you know, obviously, you even if you just look at the movies, how many vampire movies have there been?
Well, again, Bela Lugosi, Christopher Lee.
Which, by the way, all very interesting Draculas and other things.
Gary Oldman.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, that's right. I forgot about that one.
Yeah. And some are closer to the book. Some are closer to their own interpretation. Some are really silly, like I've seen Blackula and so forth. You know, I've seen parodies. Abbott Costello beat Frankenstein, which includes the Wolfman, Dracula, and Frankenstein's monster.
Oh, you know, I don't know why, but you know what the movie comes to mind that's a silly movie for a vampire movie?
Which?
Love at First Bite.
Good choice.
You know, which, George Hamilton, which was oddly, you know, for the style of what they were going with, you're like, hey, okay. You know, and it was one of those weird movies that was just like, okay, you know, at that time, I don't know, what was that? Was that the late 70s? Obviously, I think it was Disco. Was the thing?
Yeah, it sounds right. Yeah, it's been a while since that movie.
It's a strange movie when you sit down and think about it, but it's like, you know, at least in that movie, you know, he's a sympathetic character for whatever reason, you know?
Yeah. Well, again, it's always, well, basically, vampires, besides being a living embodiment of the STD, they're also an example of a drug addict. You know, they might be the nicest guys on earth, but when the hunger takes over, you better not be nearby. Because if you're lucky, they'll stop. And if you know, if they don't, well, you're dead. Or worse, you're an addict too.
Yeah.
So. You know, and you can really have fun playing with that element there. Like I've seen TV shows like Being Human where they really play that up and so forth. But, again, there's so many options and scenarios you could try it on. Depending on how campy you want to get. But I think we'll go for the Monster Mash near the end once we've gone through all the individual monsters. Yeah.
So let's talk about the Mummy.
Ah, yes.
You know. And I swear we've talked about the Mummy before. We probably have talked about all these before, but it's just like, I love, you know, I'm a big fan of the old classic movies. So things like this, I'll talk about this anyway. I don't care if I've talked about it 20 times.
Yes. And again, the Mummy is such a weird creature because originally they played him as the brilliant mastermind. You know what I mean? In the original Mummy thing, he was this great being that actually had ancient power from beyond the grave, not unlike Dracula.
Right.
Then there was a period where basically he was considered a glorified, you know, he was undead, basically wrapped in a stocking, for lack of a better term. And then when Brendan Fraser brought him back, you know, back in the 90s, he came back to being, well, yeah, he's essentially a living pharaoh. And his main crime is he was basically buried alive.
Right.
Because of his crimes and so forth. And it's ultimately a love story in the original one, in the one that was done by Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. I think that was always, you know, in the original Mummy movies. And obviously the one in Brendan Fraser was kind of a weird love story.
Yeah.
You know. And, you know, and it's funny, though. I mean, I think I like the idea of mummies, but even though I know there are non-Egyptian mummies,
mm-hmm.
in my mind, the Mummy is so linked to the concept mm-hmm. of some Egyptian-style society. that at least in the past. Doesn't matter if there's not one currently. And I think that's why I've always had a hard time using mummies in a game, because then it's like, again, it's like, well, are they just second-rate creatures? You know, I mean, it's almost like D&D. They're not quite, and I mean, this is not a complaint. This is just an observation. Mm-hmm. It's like, I think, again, we kind of use them as like you said, oh, they're undead. We're just, you know, and I think, again, vampires have that problem too. It's like, oh, it's just some more undead. It's like at least, like, for example, for me, out of all the undead, I've always loved skeletons most, because it's like, hey, none of them have any brains. It makes perfect sense why someone would have a bunch of skeletons, animated skeletons around, doing their bidding. Okay, I get that, you know?
Exactly.
You know, it's like...
go on.
But, you know, when it gets to something like, obviously, like mummies and stuff, you're just like, why is there so many? You know, it's like, you know, it's like, why would you have so many? Why would, you know, it's like, you know, you only should have one or two or three max, you know, and they should be something special. And a lot of times when I've seen them presenting, it's like, they're not only special. I mean, I don't want to say that they don't feel threatening, but I really do. I feel like I'm not really threatened by them in some way. It's just like, oh, it's a mummy. Let's just run. But you don't have like, I don't know. I think this is a weird thing that it's tough as a game master to do, to really instill the fear that you response that you want to insert to your players. You know, it's almost like people, again, you know, it's like if they don't have the connection to the source material, it's like, on the one hand, it's like, well, I've read all the source material. I you know, they might be reacting to that, but there's almost like it's hard to get the players invested in what I feel is like the necessary fear factor.
Yeah. And arguably the mummy niche, what it should be, if you go for some of the original material, as far as from a Hollywood movie perspective, it's a lich. It's an undead priest from beyond the grave of ancient power and immense abilities. And the main reason we kind of associate that with it, of course, is the mummy's curse. And that's why the mummy, more than any other of these creatures, I'd argue, is a product of its time. Because the mummy was done as a response to the breaking open of King Tut's tomb. You know, all the superstitions, the legends, and the mysterious deaths that happened because of it. Some of them have been disproven since then.
Oh, yeah.
But that element of, he cursed you from afar because you broke into his things, even though King Tut, by pharaoh standards, was actually kind of an also-ran, if you think about it. And that's the only reason we know anything about him. He wasn't worth looting.
Well,
which tells you how much somebody like Cheops or Hasesha would have been.
Oh, well, they're, you know, that, and it's, yeah. And especially, you know, when you actually look at what was in there, you're just like, holy crap. And he, you know, as you pointed out, he wasn't worth looting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What the hell was, you know, but, you know, but it is interesting when you, I mean, obviously when you look at actual, you know, Egyptian.
Also,
you know, mm-hmm. there were a lot more mummies than people think, because a lot of people just mummified. Here you go. Let's just throw you all in this grave. We have mummies stacked up five high. No problem.
Exactly. Like, there was to the point where they were actually using them for fuel for freaking railways. It was that many mummies when it comes down to it here. For me, as a trained archaeologist, that almost feels like traitor. But well, one of the greatest archaeologists of all time was basically an Italian strongman turned acrobat, you know, turned gravedigger.
Well, I mean, we could have a whole episode on what's wrong with archaeology.
Oh, God, yes. So you almost, like, I'd say you'd almost need two. Like, you have your standard mooks, which would basically be emulated with skeletons and zombies. And then you'd have, if you have a big bad, who's like one of these great pharaohs that comes beyond the grave, or an absurder, or what have you, or a high priest, that's a lich.
You know, and you I guess that is true. I mean, the lich really does, is the mummy that we kind of think of when we think of the mummy.
Yeah, he's buried beyond his grave. He might use an illusion to look human, but he's been dead for a long time. He's incredibly powerful magically.
Yeah.
And he's got a few tricks up his sleeves. And good old-fashioned curses are just D&D spells, or whatever spell system you prefer to use if you're using a different system. And, of course, then you get into the pyramids, which, even though there's actually other grave goods of other cultures and so forth, you always think of the pyramids or the Valley of the Pharaohs when it comes to, well, the dungeon.
Oh, yeah.
And you got a lich in a dungeon, that's Egypt. You know, as far as from pop culture references, even though it's not really based on fact, but it's cool enough that you want to keep it.
Yeah. No, I mean, that is true.
Mm-hmm. Like, I would argue that, you know how a long time ago we said if medieval society standard is a 1 and Norse culture is a 2, Egypt's got to be a 2 as well, or maybe even a 3 at most, because it's probably the most emulated culture when it comes to fiction. And at the top, the mummy.
Well, that, I mean, let's face it, I mean, a lot of D&D, there's been a lot of D&D adventures that have revolved around, if not, you know, pyramid, I mean, there's a lot of pyramids and various D&D adventures. I mean, you go to, I remember, what the fuck was that one? That was, there was the adventure in the basic set. I forget what the hell the actual, was it B4? That had the pyramid? I'm going to say it was, where, like, players get lost in the desert and they ended up discovering a pyramid.
The one I'm thinking of is Deserts of Desolation. Is that the one you're thinking of, or
no,
a different
one? This is actually a different one. Let's go. Let me actually look this up. Because I used to have it. The Lost City.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
That's what it was. It was The Lost City. And yeah. it was an interesting adventure because it's like the pyramid was the entrance to, like, this lost underground city. And it's like, and it's so funny because of the way, and basic D&D, clerics didn't really, I'm a cleric, but you never had to declare what your religion was,
mm-hmm.
which was really weird. But then, you know, players could join the, you know, there's like these different city factions and, you know, you could only be full members if you were certain classes.
Yeah.
And they had obviously a war going on with each other. I know they expanded that one. At some point, I think there was an expansion to that, but yeah, you know, you mentioned what was the other one? Desert of Desolation. That's a classic one that obviously mm-hmm. had a lot of D&D tropes. I mean, not D&D tropes, a lot of, you know, obviously yeah. Egyptian tropes in it.
Yeah, and I would argue if D&D is going to do a fifth edition version of a reskin, if they're going to keep reproducing old products, Desert of Desolation should be near the top of the list. If they're going to keep, you know, basically regurgitating their past. I would argue they've done all the big ones, and this is the next big one they should do, if not this year, the next, before they switch over to a new edition. Because it brings on a whole different element than a lot of their other environments, if they're going to stay within the Forgotten Realms. Because, you know, but that being said, it wouldn't be that hard to set up, like, a mummy tomb, you know, tomb adventure, where, like, one of the most interesting concepts I had actually was a pulp game where one of my players literally played King Tut who woke up in the 1930s. And let's just say when he found out his company got foreclosed due to lack of debt payment, the Egyptians to the British Empire, he was very depressed.
That's funny.
Okay. But basically, if you want to play a mummy in the game, I would say just play a mystic and either do a reincarnation or you just walk down and you wear wrappings. And that's how you can play the character without changing your rules too much. And then just use the spells to emulate his spellcasting ability. Like, I would say it's a sorcerer, because you have innate powers from the gods.
Yeah, I could see that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that might be a good, especially, because, I mean, was it Pathfinder that had finally had sorcerers were differentiated by different types?
Yeah.
You know, they have, like, bloodlines is what they had. And wasn't mm-hmm. one of them, like, you know, some sort of weird necromantic or something like that?
Well, it's possible. Like, I know they, for a while there, they were basically experimenting with power sources in both Pathfinder and then 4th and then 5th edition. Yeah. You know, where they basically did, they probably did, I know they did Dragon and Wild for sure. But I could easily argue a Vistage, I guess, would be the one I would pick for that. Kind of, you're going off your ancestors, and I guess you could argue if you reskin it there, so you wouldn't have to build a cleric or something. Or you could just build them as a cleric and be done with it.
Well, I think a sorcerer would be an interesting build.
Yeah.
So,
you know, or that, or a warlock, where you basically have a pack with things from beyond time and existence.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, that's what I think that was definitely one of them as an option. So, yeah, that'd be interesting.
Okay.
You know, and let's go into the other one here, Wolfman, which is kind of a weird one because obviously the Wolfman was was a werewolf, but they didn't call him a werewolf per se.
Yeah. Basic. Go on, sorry.
Well, I'm just saying, but it's weird because it was one of those ones where, you know, I think they always drove to say it was a werewolf, but I don't know. It's always like, at least from the standpoint of the movies, they, you know, at least those classic movies, almost a more sad character, you know, a character mm-hmm. that you could be very sympathetic towards, because usually stuck in a, you know, it's like, I didn't want to be the wolf man. I didn't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, it's the ultimate curse.
Sympathetic. That's what I was looking for.
Because you could be the nicest guy, except that one day a month. In that one day a month, you're essentially a monster that needs to be quarantined or put down. Like, they always played him as a sympathetic monster, where as opposed to just a straight shapeshifter, because, you know, there's always been lycanthropy in myth. In fact, that's why I argue that's why Gary Gygax used lycanthrope as his term. So he expanded out and tried different shapeshifting creatures, like the werewolf, the were-rat, were-tiger, etc. In fact, they made an ECL, well, basically a first-level version called the Shifter, which plays an incredibly prominent role in Eberron, because, long story short, the equivalent of the Catholic Church in that location went on a lycanthropy hunt. So basically, shifters were almost hunted to extinction. Hmm. Which adds a really unique element here, because Eberron doesn't really go for the absolutes here when it comes to good or bad, because, well, it gives you more of a pulp feel when it comes down to that thing. In fact, if I'd argue that of all the games that are going to emulate the horror movie monsters while still having the high action, it would be Eberron, because it has that feeling of the interwar period in a fantasy campaign, which a lot of these movies were designed to be in, you know. And I would argue that the pulp era is one of the best eras to play in, because you have enough technology to get in trouble, but not enough to get out.
Oh, well, I love that.
Well, you got a plane, you got a car, you got a radio, no, but you don't have, I don't know, your cell phone.
Well, I think that's one of those weird things that I've always told people I've come across, is that as much as I love science fiction and I love playing science fiction, for a lot of things, there's a lot of adventure settings where it's like, I want to place an age that's recognizable for people, but mm-hmm. I almost don't want to be the modern era.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I've said this for like spy games. I don't really I'd rather play the spy era between the 60s and 80s, any day of the yeah. week, you know,
yeah.
compared to argue. Modern day mm-hmm. or, you know, and you, I mean, even action adventure stuff. It's like, I'd rather, you know, anything from the 1930s to the 1970s is to me is a hell of a, or even the 80s. I like, again, like I said, or yeah. is a hell years of a before more internet. Exciting than anything else I could think of.
Yeah. Like, I would argue one of the reasons why Lovecraft keeps getting set in the 20s is because they got enough technology to get in trouble. And that's also why the Hollywood monsters work well in that era as well. Because, you know, you can have your banquet, you can have your issues with, you know, the second rise of the clan and so forth. But what happens when a minority of your choice here ends up being a wolf man? And one of his side effects is he's basically acting as a revenge weapon against, say, the Ku Klux Klan. Which side do you go down on? You know, or are, you know, you know what a silver bullet or a silver cane, depending on the original and so forth. Like, I've never understood why silver became the weapon, other than maybe it was picked there out of their hat. Like, I don't remember if that was in the original tales, so somebody smarter than me is going to have to ask that question there. And
yeah,
also,
yeah, you know, I don't know, but, you know, it's interesting that you mention that. And of course, that's where there's references to silver weapons all throughout various D&D for various creatures.
Yeah. Well, it was the first weapon you had that was weird and exotic, other than the weapon you had for your standard fighting.
Right.
Because, you know, you never knew when you run into it. That and Wolvesbane, which you got there. And also, in a lot of fiction, especially before they start canonizing everything back in the 20s, the line between the wolfman and the vampire was really blurry. Like, often because the character died and then came back and seemed to be okay, until that fateful day when he basically shifted into, well, a monster. And also, what do you do when you don't want to kill your best friend, but he's causing trouble? Like, it could actually act more as a story element than it could as an actual... Like, some of the others you can just reskin and so forth. If you're shape-shifting, I guess the best question I have is, how much control do you have over your character? Because you could easily emulate it by just playing a druid in D&D. Because you say shape-shifting and you just pick one form and you basically use that as your basis. And then you, whatever else is, you know, is color text.
Well, you know, it is interesting, though, that... Rolemaster, way back in the day, this mm-hmm. early, I mean, this stuck in the early the RM2 days, one of the weird, there was various tables that you could roll in for background stuff, and one of the results was, is I think you were a werecreature, and it had some very basic rules where I don't think you actually had, I think over time you could develop the skill to control your change, but initially you didn't have control over your ability to change.
Yeah, and also going to add certain elements here, like, you know, it's one thing to put it in the middle of, what was the original one? It was in England, wasn't it? It was in London, right? It's been a while.
Yeah.
You know, the original Wolfman show. But if you change it and you put a little bit of historical context or even some modern context, like, I'll be blunt, a Wolfman who wolfed out in today's era post-1985, he'd be caught really fast. Because you can't cover up your trail because you're a wolf monster at that time. You know, and we have cameras at that point, and then later we have internet. So if it's a single solitary monster, it's got a finite lifespan. However, if they do what they did like in Werewolf the Apocalypse and it's a wolf clan, then it gets interesting because then you can work on the buddy system, depending on how much control they have. Like, you know, you could basically use wolf behavior where you have some wolves running distraction, other ones going for the kill, others running off, you know, basically making sure, guiding the people in. Like, what happens when you wake up and you realize you're being hunted by essentially a wolfman pack? And especially if you're in, like, the middle of nowhere, like, I live in a hostile environment known as Canada, and if you go up north, there's nobody around. Hell, your cell phone reception probably stinks. And if you're doing that in, say, minus 30 weather where they're not really affected by the weather, that's bloody terrifying.
All right.
You know.
Why don't we cover the last one so we can get through these, which is the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah.
Or the, you know, or as like some people say, might be the you know, the aquatic missing link.
Exactly. Well, you know, there's that horrible... like hypothesis, I think has been disproven, called the aquatic apes, and you could argue there. Whereas the Koa-Toa are probably closer to the deep ones, I would argue the Sasquan are probably closer to the creature of the Black Lagoon, even though they're actually a lot more organized. It's not just one race. Also, for its era, it was a piece of media marvel because they were able to do underwater scenes for the first time. Like, it sounds stupid, but it wasn't. Like, it's kind of amazing. And it's also arguably the last of the classic movies before they started bouncing again and trying to branch out and so forth.
Yeah.
But you know.
Yeah. You know, I think this is probably... I definitely have to say any sort of weird creature from the Black Lagoon or anything like that. The aquatic creatures, I typically have a hard time using them in a game, mostly because I don't think I've actually... run too many. It's sometimes hard to come up with a scenario that makes sense, you know.
Yeah,
the closest I've come is, you know, some coastal towns, but even then, I mean, I forget what the hell adventure I was playing where it was a coastal town, but it really was more, it was more Cthulhu based than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had, you know, I think all of the players eventually we got infected enough that we were all turning into fish people.
Yikes.
You know, and it's just like, you know, and it was Pathfinder adventure, and I remember playing it, and I was telling someone, I said, you know, the problem I have with this adventure is not that we're turning into fish people, you know, because we want to eventually find a way to cure ourselves of that, is that this adventure is so long, so hard, and to get certain things, it was like, here, get on the miracle round of the mystical, you know, keep that's floating around in a circle in here. And I'm just like, God, this is just fucking ridiculous. It's like, unless you knew, it's like, unless you actually had certain capabilities, none of that was easy. And it wouldn't even be something that you would even contemplate. I wouldn't be going into the keep that's flipping end over end, circling around in a location like a weird merry-go-round. You know, it's like, I'm going to skip that. And I don't remember. Yeah. And the funny thing is, I think there was something in there that we needed. And I was telling someone, I said, you know, if it wasn't the fact that we were just searching everything, why would you ever go in there?
Yeah.
There's like no, you're not getting a hint like, oh, there might be something in there. You just happen to, and I think that's the problem with a lot of D&D adventures over time, where it's like, why would you go there? There's no reason, there's no hint to go somewhere. Even it's just so random that if you go over here, you find the key that opens up that gate over there. Well, there's never a hint, and I'm not talking about railroading per se, but it's not like, you need to open that gate, and you know that this ogre has the key because you've heard rumors that he wears a golden key around his neck. That's different than, I slayed this poor beggar, and then I looked under his beggar's carpet, and oh my God, there was a key that I needed. Why would I ever attack the beggar? Why would I know that?
Yeah, then you end up in Gygaxian adventures where you're basically digging anywhere and hoping for the best. But I would argue the one that probably has the closest in D&D mythology that probably fixes a lot of birds with one stone is still the Yue Trilogy, The Sinister Secret of Soulsmarsh, Danger of Dunwater, The Final Enemy. Because it gets you ready 3 levels ahead of time to the idea that you're going to be going underwater. Hmm. Like, you basically start, it starts as essentially, the Innesmouth Horror, not the Innesmouth, the one with the fish people. I can't remember its name for the life of me, which tells you how tired I am. And then you end up dealing with the lizard men who show you that it's actually the Sasquatch and they've been causing all the problems. And one of the things you pick up, among other things, are things like potions of water breathing, helm of underwater action. So that when you actually have a reason to go underwater and you're already ready with the right equipment on hand. Whereas, unless you have a reason to go underwater and you're in your typical fantasy campaign, you don't want to do it. Like, dude, we don't want to do it with modern technology and drones. Why would we want to go down there if all your high-tech equipment is basically considered a chain coif? You know, and that's probably one of the biggest limitations is as soon as there's things under the sea, you need a reason to get there. And that's why the creature, you probably want to almost do a local thing. Like, I hate to say it, but if I were going to use anything that was like Creature from the Black Lagoon, my default would actually be the Bullywug of all things. You know, those evil frog people that are probably older than dirt, but they kind of fill the same niche where you're not having to go into the deep sea to go deal with them. They're actually just a local problem and the water's deep, but it's not, you're not diving. And you could also put in stuff like swamp and so forth. There's various other things, and swamp, well, painful to deal with, doesn't feel like a complete barrier stop.
No, plus I think a good swamp is creepy.
Yeah.
And I say that because, well, not that I've lived in these swamplands, but I've definitely seen a lot of swampland in my time. And you're like, yeah, it's not homey. I don't want to be there. It seems a little creepy. What's with that old mission building over there in the swamp?
Exactly. And on top of that, then you got the weird parasites or weird diseases.
Yep.
You got the inability to travel.
Leeches.
But leeches, of course. They're always fun here. And, of course, if you're more temperate, tropical environment, you got alligators or constrictor snakes on top of the creature from the Black Lagoon, which may or may not be organizing them.
Or any number of actual water snakes.
Yeah. But you need a reason for there to actually go there to fight them if you're not just on an XP grind. And I guess one of the best options is they took something that you probably didn't want that you want back, whether it's a possession or a person. but of course that's just some speculation here. This one I have absolutely no idea other than, say, pulling the Lovecraft card and saying, your father was a fish, and one day you'll turn into one.
Your father was a fish, and one day you'll turn into one. Oh, that's funny.
You know. Well, yeah, exactly. And, well, I guess you could play like a merfolk if you really want to. You know, like, I think there's rules for them somewhere. But the problem with playing something that's really suitable for the water is nobody else is.
Yeah, I mean, you almost have to have a water-based campaign, which could be interesting.
Like, it's completely doable, but this is one where you'd have to talk like rule zero first.
Yeah.
And honestly, for the same effect, I'd probably do it like in a marsh or something. And also, you can pull the Lost Civilization card. Like, it got buried, it created the swamp and basically buried itself in there. And therefore, if you look underneath the Everglades of, say, Florida, you'll find a temple of some sort or a castle or something, or even just a monument. And that's when things get really interesting. You know, and of course, you could always pull the old The Hills Have Eyes if you really want to. When it comes to other creatures other than just the creature from the Black Lagoon or whatever race it is. And therefore, you got other bandits or other PCs that might be unsavory, or they might not be. You don't know. But you got to deal with them. And it gives you enough of a transitionary point where you can go from one point to the other. But of course, that's speculation. Okay. Now we've gone through the most common individual monsters. I guess we could go through the Invisible Man as well, but honestly, that's a one-trick pony. That's basically you take a spell, you cast it, and you can be basically a human with nefarious skills.
Yeah, I think we can skip that one.
Yeah. You know, what other ones can we think of? Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? Or is that a little bit post?
I don't know. That's kind of a strange one, because, I mean, that's more of the whole... I mean, I guess it's kind of a classic monster in a way, because especially, you know, Mr. Hyde is kind of the repressed person who doesn't have rules.
Yeah, exactly. Well, basically it's just a psychological thing, but in many ways it's already covered kind of by the Wolfman concept, archetype.
Yeah.
Where...
I mean, one could argue that in some ways the Wolfman is... the epitome of that concept.
Yeah.
At least for the classical movies, you know. Okay, you have the wolf when there actually are the in the wolf form, you know, they may not even recognize friend or foe.
Yeah.
So,
you know, whereas this one's more actively malevolent, but that's easy enough to build. Like, maybe it's demonic possession, maybe it's mind control. You know, there's lots of ways to basically mess with a character and basically give him a dark aspect of some sort. Well, I guess we talked about the individual monsters for the most part. Now, how do you bring them all together?
Invite them to a party.
Exactly. Like, the much more offensive Monster Mash. Like, again, I bring it up way too many times, but I have to bring it up now. Of course, it's Monster Squad, Abbott and Costello, Scooby-Doo. Everybody's had, for lack of a better term, one of those experiences where they throw everybody in a blender, you know, where sometimes the Hunchback plays a prominent role as well, you know.
Oh,
and then when you add in additional monsters and so forth, it gets weirder, especially when you mix in Atomic Horror or other aspects there. Like, I actually think one of the most interesting concepts, which World of Darkness kind of did, but they did it more as almost a cold, you know, there. Build a culture where you take the five basic monsters and instead of being competitive with each other under humanity's nose, what if they got to deal with each other? Kind of, they basically have their own, for lack of a better term, monster ecology. Whereas there's certain agreements and certain trends that you do. Like, if you have an agreement between the five major clans, let's say Dracula, Frank, you know, Frankenstein, Wolfman, Mummy, and the Creature from the Black Lagoon, and they all cover different aspects, and they all have their own turf within the human world, but they've kind of come out, You know? Like, the forest is vampire territory, just for argument's sake. Whereas the plains is werewolf territory. Whereas the swamps are Creature from the Black Lagoon territory. The desert is mummy territory. And Frankenstein's urban areas. And then you got to deal with each other. And they basically have this weird symbiotic relationship where the vampire goes to Frankenstein's monster for muscle, or the wolfmen are trackers and so forth. And then you could actually, what would be kind of fun is if you take that concept, you know, basically a universal monster universe, and then you throw them against Lovecraftian horrors. Yeah. Unlike how much out of their gauge would they be? Or would they actually be aware? Because if a vampire has been around for 2,000 years, yeah, he knows Yogg-Sothoth. You know, even if he'd rather not, you know? Maybe that's how he got immortality.
Maybe that's why he doesn't invite him around to dinner parties. I don't know.
Exactly.
I know that guy. He's a dick.
Yeah, exactly. That jerk always brings his... Yeah, Azathoth's a pain in the ass. He always brings those flute players. Nobody likes those. Yeah. I think I might... put a tip to, you know, pin in that one, because I might steal it from my own concepts.
Okay, well, we'll let you put a pin in that. You never know.
You know.
All right, well, I think for time purposes, I think we need to cut this one.
Okay.
So that was kind of interesting. I'd like to hear people's thoughts on how they've used the classic movie monsters and, you know, what approach they've used.
Yep.
Because I think it would be very interesting to hear what people have done with them, you know. Have you stuck with some of the classic tropes? Have they been successful using some of the classic tropes? What have you modified to try to more fit with what you think your sensibility for these monsters should be, as opposed to what's on, you know, obviously what's on the written page? I mean, that applies to any monster, but specifically I'd like to hear about these. So.
Yeah, and exactly. And if you think there's certain monsters that should be part of the, I guess, universal monster canon, or would make sense to do so, like, for example, Medusa... What if there's an entire race of snake women, for lack of a better term, which sounds like something they should have done in the Universal Monsters but never did? Let us know.
Well, you know, who wants statuary everywhere?
Exactly. Shedding all over the place, man. You wouldn't believe how you got to clean up.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about the Bottle of Holy before we get to the Kickstarter, shall we?
Sure.
There's really two Kickstarters that are still ongoing. First one is going to be Heroes Unlimited from, obviously, that's the Palladium Games superhero system. If you've played, like, even, like, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles from Palladium, you've kind of played the system, you know. I mean, it's their, I don't know, did you ever play Palladium's superhero version?
Not directly, but I have... played it in, like, for example, as a Riff's characters. I've had him thrown in there for good measure. It was a product of its time, and he used the Palladium system. I think that's all I really need to say about it.
Yeah.
I would argue some of the best products were done by Bill Coffin, where he actually started expanding beyond generic superhero campaign number 35, where he started adding his own ideas and concepts. I would argue their best superhero environment is actually one they did for, of all things, Riffs, called Scrapers, where they took the concept of essentially an alien invasion triggered off superheroes. And so now you have this occupying force of, you know, aliens that are kind of burly, like typical 80s aliens that are, you know, basically invading marauders, having to deal with, you know, the superheroes that are basically trying to defend off the planet because it's an occupation. Of course, you know, that's just the only one that comes to mind here. Like, the 14 was never really my bag, so I can tell you about the rules, but honestly, I don't want to bore anybody here.
You know, it's funny, what you just described is kind of Pinnacle's necessary evil, but with the villains fighting the aliens.
I don't know. I stand by that. It's actually one of the most original concepts I've heard in a long time. Like, I'm surprised either Marvel or DC didn't do it, because that would be a really interesting comic. Could you imagine, like, dealing with Dr. Doom or Magneto versus aliens?
Well, just think of the internal power plays that would always happen. They all want to save the world, but they're in their own way.
Exactly. Doesn't mean we can't make a profit.
Oh, and at the end, they want to be the person on top.
Yep.
It kind of reminds me of most guerrilla warfare scenarios, you know, where you have freedom fighters. You know, they all want to fight the good fight and defeat the bad guy, but then when it's over, they're the ones that want to be in charge.
Oh, absolutely, and that often is the biggest detriment to after the fact, because usually they declare each other counter-revolutionaries and they try to kill each other.
Yep.
Assuming they even beat them up in the first place. Like, you know, whether you talk about revolutionary France or 1848 or Russia, nice guys don't win revolutions.
Typically not, no.
You know, and then, yeah.
So, why don't we get to the other bundle of holding? We could go down that rabbit hole for a long time.
Yeah, there's a lot of rabbit holes we can go down. We're going to try to avoid them.
Yeah. The other bundle of holding is Travel the New Era, which, I don't know. Did you ever play Travel the New Era at all?
That one, I'm afraid I have not. So, that's totally on me.
You did not miss much. I do not believe. The only positive thing that ever I can say about it is for people who liked the house system that GDW had, well, this was it. I mean, this was Travel using the house system that they developed for, like, Dark Conspiracy.
Okay.
And stuff. I never cared for... It was also their answer to... Well, we started Mega Traveler, and we had this empire-shattering war going on. How are we going to end it and just get back to doing weird exploration or something? And their answer was, I know, we'll have the virus, which made no fucking sense, in my opinion. And, you know, and there are people that were like, no, it was great. And I'm thinking, you know what? No. But okay. You know, and so... You know, one of the big things was these vampire fleets, which were basically automated starships that just jumped around the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, I could see one, maybe two ships like that somehow, but I don't know. I never got into the way it worked. And I had the rules for a while. I think I had the basic set and I had a few other pieces of materials. I even had the actual Brilliant Lances, which was their... Not only their that was the weird thing. Their starship construction rules were in there, and then their like ship-to-ship combat was in there.
And okay.
So, which I always thought was lame. It's like, that was one of the things that was great about Travelers. You could always have at least a starship design system within the rule book, so you didn't need to buy a separate supplement for it unless you really wanted to do something spectacular, you know, different.
Yeah.
You know, where here, no, here are the standard ones, and then let's go this route. And of course... Every version prior and after this one, the drives were not reaction drives, if that makes any sense.
Oh.
You know.
Okay.
You know, it's like you didn't have chemical burn rockets in previous versions of Traveler, nor post this. I mean, obviously, because like the Mongoose version of Traveler actually, you know, is basically little rack books. So... I don't know. It's out there. I mean, they're looking for like $14 to get like the rule book, Survival Margin, the World Tamer's Handbook, the Vampire Fleets, and a collection of forms. And then obviously, if you spend the other amount, you get the T&E, that's the Travel of the New Era, the Regency Source Books, the Star Vikings, the Atlas of the Rim, the GM screen. And I'm not familiar with
The Gilded Lily?
The Gilded Lily. I am next. I guess that was a series of adventures that they did.
Okay.
Yeah. I just was not. It was just not my thing. As a matter of fact, the material I did had, I eventually sold at I turned into a used bookstore that took it for credit.
Okay. I guess that answers that question right there.
Yeah. I'm not saying it was bad, but it was not my cup of tea. And I know some people that this is the version that they prefer. And I'm saying, hey, if this is the version you prefer and you're missing something in this list, it might be worth looking at.
Yeah. So. And if you play this, we're more than happy to have you guys respond with a rebuttal if you want to.
No, I think most people tend to... I mean, obviously, there would be no Mongoose Traveler version that people are playing if obviously this was the preferred version.
Exactly.
You know, and but I know some people that they really liked the idea of the vampire fleets, and I think that was the hardest pill to swallow for most people. It wasn't all the other stuff. I mean, even the virus somehow taking down all the computer systems, that was one thing, but the whole, you know, it was too Terminator-esque where you would have, like, an artificial intelligent robot. Oh, my God, it got infected with the virus. Now it's trying to kill everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is, when you deal with something as big as Traveler Space, even if it was going pretty much at 100, you know, at maximum speed, it's going to take at least a century before you notice it. You know, unless you land on a very specific planet.
Well, supposedly the virus was really fast acting, so.
Yeah, but at the same time, let's assume vehicles move at light speed. Let's say we're trying to get a virus from Earth to Alpha Centauri. That's years. And not always the most fun thing to watch unless you basically press the fast forward button.
Yeah. All right, so let's get to the Kickstarter, shall we? So we can close all this stuff out.
Okay, sure.
First up, the Protean role-playing system. And this is just was described as a very minimal pre-game prep. And they were only looking for, well, the equivalent of a $1,100, a little more. They got $75.
Okay.
I think my problem that I think the problem that they're facing is that they don't have a lot of stuff described. It's just, oh, this system is flexible storytelling, and you can do high fantasy, cyberpunk, superhero. And I'm like, yeah, that's great. There's already just a lot of these type of games out there.
Yeah, well, like we said before, if you got an original system, you're going to have to show us it. And there's not even a video here to show, hey, here's how you play.
Yeah, so.
You know, like, normally we kind of poo-poo those things, but if it said, hey, here's how you play it.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, like the Keychain RPG, that was at least something interesting.
Yeah.
You know, but this, there's just too many. We've said it before. I mean, RPGs are a small market, and then you're trying to slice the pie even thinner. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But for this, I'm going to say it probably doesn't.
Yeah.
So this next one up is the Summerland Tabletop RPG Second Edition. And I've never heard of the first edition.
Sorry, when I hear Summerland, the first response is the old Lone Wolf role-playing game, so I'm going to have to take a look at this.
Yeah, this is the description that they have. The event brought the Sea of Leaves into our world, an immense forest that choked cities and drowned civilization overnight. From the trees came the call, a lure to the weak that decimated the population. In the aftermath, only pockets of humanity remain, resisting the wood siren song, and the endless forest looking the lost, whose wills are drowned out by the call, and the wild who have forgotten they were ever human. You are one of the select few who can resist the call, a drifter hardened to the lure of the woods by the scars of the past. You cannot let go. Your torment shields you, but drives your isolation. More than anything, you crave welcome in a community, but can never be truly accepted without leaving behind your past. To do that, you must confront and defeat the demons that haunt you. What will you risk for redemption? So it's some sort of weird fantasy post-apocalyptic world?
I'm getting flashbacks to a Doctor Who episode. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think that's a thing.
Well, there's so many things that remind me of Doctor Who episodes.
Yeah, no, there was one where they basically took over the forest of London and basically trees started taking over the world. I won't go into too many details. It has a different twist than the other one.
So it's based on the Open D6 mechanics.
Okay, well, we know the system at least.
Yeah. I don't know. It's an interesting concept. Not necessarily my cup of tea, but I give it some points. It actually, it's about 3/4 of its goal. I mean, it still has 32 days to go.
Yeah, there's a good chance it'll make its cut here. I guess who, if anybody's listening who's involved in this Kickstarter, this is one I'd be interested in hearing your elevator speech on. You know, not beyond the video. Like, maybe I might even click on the video just to see how they sell the actual product here. I might do it afterwards.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, all right. So next up, we have a Savage Worlds licensed product called Darkhold, Terror from the Black Isles RPG. And I don't know. First off, I'm an old. I kind of like the weird armored ducks. Those are ducks.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think that's a holdover from me just obviously playing RuneQuest.
Yeah, that's kind of my first thought when I look at that there. I'm just reading the elevator speech here. Terror from the Thing is the third in the Darkhold Goblin Adventure series and Rebel Minis and written by Andrew J. Lucas. It follows the Giant General Fantasy as their previous releases, expanding upon the world of information provided by the main rule book, but emphasizing the adventurer plot.
So this is so this is an adventure for the I guess that rule set, huh? I mean,
mm-hmm.
And I've never heard of the rule set, the Darkhold Goblin Adventures.
No, that one's totally by me here. But obviously, this is their third product. They must have had some influence here, and it looks like they made their cut. And they didn't really ask for that much money, so maybe they just go for a soft release or something. Yeah. Oh no, they got an adventurer box. That's even weirder. Because they're, you know, not asking for a lot of money for a print copy. And they're obviously making a parody of the original D&D, you know, I can't remember which one it is. Monster Manual, I think it is. Where they got a picture of the goblin that's basically the same parody as that demon statue back in the original AD&D era.
Oh, yeah. That's the original Player's Handbook.
That's it, yeah.
Well, you know, so many people have done parodies of that cover.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure Tramper's spinning in his grave.
Yeah. I'm sure he is, but they made their money. It's still a little nervous about the price point, but maybe Savage World doesn't need as many page counts. I do not know.
All right. Speaking of Traveler and Mongoose, they are doing the Traveler RPG Element Class Cruisers box set. So just what you need, and they've actually reached their goal. So it's a box set for, hey, everything you need to know about a cruiser with maps, which I just can't even imagine. And they're going to it's going to include 10 gigantic, two-sided, full-color blueprints laying out every deck of the ship.
I'd like to say why, but I own a book that basically did a mothership that's about the size of, I don't know, one of those, like a Heroes Unlimited book, just on a friggin' ship. So I can't really judge. If anything, this is your wheelhouse more than mine at this point for Traveler.
You know, it's weird, though, because, you know, they say Element Class Cruisers, and maybe it's because I've just seen so many ship designs. This ship looks familiar.
And yeah.
It just might be the general design. Yeah, but then it's the classic, you know, Traveler heavy ship design that has a spinal mount, so.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably why, but I swear I've seen this basic design somewhere else.
Well, maybe you saw it from some of your old books. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe the ones.
Well, at least they're not doing the other one, the Colonial Cruisers again.
Okay, good. Yeah.
So let's see, what are we looking at here? If you want all the things as a PDF download, looks like about $35 US. Which, and then if you want the actual box set, it's about $70 US. I don't know. This is one that it would be cool to own, if you know what I mean. But
yeah.
When would I use this?
Yeah, I know that feeling.
I mean, it's kind of, I hate to tell people, it's kind of like, you know, you have it's like having the deck plans for the, you know, the Star Trek Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
If you really think about it, you almost never need the deck plans for a ship that large.
No. Because, well, it becomes its own settlement, or you basically have key areas that are...
Right. It's like, you know, it's like, hey, I need the bridge, because there will be action on the bridge. It's almost like you almost... And I think that's just the thing about maps in general. You really don't need... Sometimes you don't need the huge map. You just need, like, hey, I don't need the... I just need a map of the tavern, because that's where all the action that I'm ever going to have really takes place. Yeah. I'm not going to really need, you know, and sometimes, and I think this is a problem that we have. It's like, I almost don't need the town. I might need a description of the town, but I don't really need the town.
Yeah, well, you go back to your Star Trek analogy. You need the bridge. You need engineering. You need the holodeck. You need 10 forward, and you need your personal quarters.
Oh, and
anything else you can put on the fly.
And medical.
And medical, of course. You got to have the medical area.
Oh, in a transporter room.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got to. Yeah, got to keep Miles O'Brien employed.
But I'm just saying, you know, that. But I'm happy that they've reached their goal. I just don't see it as a must-have.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's go with, our buddy Eloy. He has the H.P. Lovecraft Preparatory Academy tabletop RPG.
Eat. Always good to hear from Third Eye Games.
Yep, he's so it's using his PIP system.
Mm-hmm.
And, just what you want to do. You want to play, you want to be in the prep school where you and your classmates are everything from mad scientists to children of monsters.
Well, it kind of goes with our theme this week.
I know.
Ah, that could be fun. Like, okay, this is the first one that really intrigues me, just because I know the people who are involved in it, and I'm also... involved in the again, it's basically because we've been spending a good chunk of the episode just talking about all sorts of monsters here, so it might be kind of fun playing essentially Scooby-Doo Ghoul School.
Yeah, there you go. So let's see, for basically every PDF, it looks like it's $15. That's not too bad. And
no.
That includes, obviously, the rules in the PDF format and then any PDF specials,
mm-hmm.
which isn't bad at all. Especially if you're not... I'm sorry to say I've never played his PIP system, so I can't comment on how well the PIP system works. But that's cool. I like that.
Eloy, this is your invite if you want it.
And he's already reached his goal.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's cool. So, there you go. If you want to play, a prep school with monsters, there's a good choice for you.
Well, again, the art types are pretty standard. It basically mixes between the 30s horror and the 50s mind scientist here. And, yeah, I could easily... This is a game where you could go with a lot of fun with. Like, you can play a hybrid, you can play a dreamer, mad scientist, well, duh. Summoners, witches, and of course, if you want to play Monday, and they're called Mondays. Yeah. So, I don't know. I find it neat, but...
Yep. All right, so let's go to Tiny Wastelands, a minimalist post-apocalyptic RPG, where they've actually reached their goal, too. They were asking for 6,000, they got 23,000.
Right on.
They say they used the minimalist Tiny D6 system.
Yeah, I think it's been on our show before.
Yeah. So, that's kind of cool. You know, sometimes I would have to say I like the idea of a post-apocalyptic game, but I can very rarely find one that I really enjoy.
Well, the tragedy of post-apocalypse is how dangerous you want it to be. Because... as awesome it is, like how realistic you want to be in the post-apocalypse, what sort of equipment you want to deal with, how weird you want to get it, because you can go for, you can essentially play Dysentery the role-playing game if you really want, but I don't think too many people would. Or you can end up playing Mad Max, Rifts, depends on the power grade and the crew. And if it's a fairly simple system that's lots of fun with a short setting filled with adventure hooks, I'd have to play the engine before I could tell you recommend it one way or the other, but I'd be curious on this one for sure.
It looks like some of their stretch goals are something they're calling micro settings.
Mm-hmm.
Micro settings are unique yet small example settings specifically designed to be used as a tool, resource, or springboard for your own campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of cool. You know, mm-hmm. It's supposed they're designed to be more of a generic setting. I mean, generic system for maybe your own version of a post-apocalyptic setting.
Yeah. Like one of my favorite, I guess, free post-apocalyptic settings was done by the former podcast of Sharkbone, where they fleshed out six different settings that were interconnected to each other based on different genres. And some of the environments they came up for their post-apocalyptic thing were just amazing. Like, they took a broken-down carrier and basically built it as an entire city. Hmm. So, just wanting a kick. And if it looks like they're doing something similar here with Salvage, Deepwater Titan, the Metal Waste. Sounds like if you unlock it after a certain point, you get basically Terminator, so that should be fun. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah. So next up we have the Princess Bride role-playing game, which...
How do I put this mildly? This one, more than any other setting, you're going to have to sell me on, because it doesn't feel like a setting so much as a narrative. Does that make any sense?
It does.
Like... I love the movie, but I couldn't see getting more than one or two games out of it, so you're going to have to sell me on a hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's otherwise it's just your typical D&D adventure. You build a party, you run around, you do nefarious things. You know, you can see you playing it with Fade. Oh, it does fudge dice. That's why. Okay, fudge actually kind of works for a system like this, because then you can play the melodramatic stuff.
Yeah, I'm just saying, though, for me, it's just one of those things where, even so, it's a great movie. It was an interesting book.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is something that you don't necessarily need a whole rule system for.
How do I put this mildly? Inconceivable. Thank you. I'll get my coat.
You'll get your coat. I mean, but it's a movie that obviously most gamers I know can quote. I mean, it's like this, obviously, Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you
mean basically the Trinity of Monty Python, Princess Bride, and Armies of Darkness.
Yeah.
Are pretty much required listening to for any gamer of a certain era and demographic.
Yeah. So, which, by the way, you know, call it sacrilege, but I actually finally caught Bruce Campbell movie Bubba Hotep on TV.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I liked it, but I know family members who have basically just about disowned me by showing up in that movie, so take it what you will.
It was a fun diversion.
Yeah. Well, again, Bruce and Ozzie Davis did a fantastic job with their characters. It's a bit of a slow burn, and it's kind of a silly premise, but
yeah.
I don't know. You know, it was fun. That's all I'm going to say.
I'd almost rather play that as an RPG than this.
Well, that actually would be a fun one-shotter, either Fiasco or Fate or something,
yeah.
Where you're playing a bunch of retired... You basically are playing Red. You know, you got a bunch of over the hill. You can decide whether you want to play old school adventurers or if they're retired.
You know, this is going to sound crazy. You know what just came to mind?
What
is something like the Scooby-Doo gang and retirement?
Oh, that could be awesome. And nobody knows why the dog is still around.
I don't know why that just came to mind. It's just one of those weird things.
That would actually be kind of awesome if you did it right. Because you got these people who... And the sad part is they would be... If you consider Scooby-Doo when they were in their 20-somethings... They're senior citizens now. So you could literally they had their great adventures back in the 60s. Oh, Jeff. Stealing idea. I don't know if it'll go anywhere, but yeah, I think you hit one.
Even a blind man can hit a ball once in a while.
Well done. As for the game itself, I'm going to stand by Fudge is a good choice for the game, but how much are they asking for it? $50. Yikes.
Yeah,
I assume it's because of the art.
$25 for the digital version.
Okay.
But
I don't know.
Yeah, this is just... they have 23 days to go, so I'm guessing they're going to hit their goal. But
no.
It's mostly people are going to buy it just because they like the movie or the book.
Well, I'd say give it a shot and see where it leads, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah. All right, so next up we have the Pirate Campaign Compendium for 5th Edition and Pathfinder, which is just a collection of pirate adventures, heroes, treasures, and more for aquatic adventures. And they've reached their goal. They're only asking 6,000. They got about three times that. And
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, and they have a version for Pathfinder, and they have a version for 5th edition. $30 for each for the PDF. If you want to get both, it's $45. They give you a small discount.
Right on.
So that's kind of
cool.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, I
like pirates as much as the next person, so it'll be fun to play with, you know.
Yeah. This one,
I think we've had an entire episode on it.
Yeah, I mean, I can. This one at least, okay, I get. So, I mean, I'm not going to be picking it up. I have other monetary things I need to be spending money on, but I get it.
Yeah. And again, pirates is one of the great iconic settings of fantasy. You know, I'd say it's number two, like in Nordic campaigns, where if you're not playing straight medieval, you're playing pirates.
Yeah. All right. So this is kind of an odd one. They reached their goal, though. Character sheets for D&D 1st and 2nd edition. Who knew? Who knew that you needed to make up new character sheets?
I find this kind of amazing that he managed to sell any money. You know, because, well, I'll be blunt. One, I haven't played 1st and 2nd edition for quite a while. And two, I still got the original character sheet types. You know, I was able to find it quite a while ago for PDF. You know, they're on RPGsheets.com, so I'm impressed as all hell that he managed to make money. Mind you, I wasn't asking for a lot, only $125 just to make a professional quality sheet. So I guess they're good, and I'm glad he made his money. So
yeah, but you know, it sounds weird, but especially for AD&D 1st edition, the original sheet to me, it's like they were definitely not great sheets.
No.
There's a nostalgic feel for that sheet. You almost, it's like, as much as I hate to say it, if I played AD&D 1st edition and I was going to actually use a character sheet rather than just a blank piece of paper.
Yeah.
I'd have to use those original sheets, even as horrible as sometimes they were.
Yeah, well, I miss the boot.
The boot. You know, I think everyone remembers the boot.
Yeah. So, but I'm not going to say nothing on these things. It's obviously based on the end of the first edition era, because that was NWPs as well as WPs. So, and again, first edition and second edition really didn't change all that much until they start really expanding about middle and second edition era. So.
All right. So next up, we have the Exfiltrators, an RPG adventure module for basically any type of OSR game from levels 4 to 5. You know me, I'm always a fan of more adventures, the better. So they're just looking for $7 for the PDF. It's okay. That's doable. They were only asking $600 total. They're at $908.
Yeah.
So,
and the basic concept is a prison break. So, you know, I think we had an episode on prisons, last year sometime?
Yeah. So that's kind of cool.
Yep.
And the last up, a gentleman actually contacted, asked us to mention his Kickstarter for the new tabletop RPGs from Melting Point Publishing. And the only... I guess this is more of a... So they're... What is this? Okay. They're actually... This is for... Right now, the big one is their push is for their Still Life and Death digital copy of their Adventure for Savage Worlds.
Okay.
For about $7. And then they actually have an adventure bundle thing that they're trying to do for about 14. And there's some other ones.
Well, they already got a module out. Yeah. You know, it's actually available on Drive Through RPG, so you can actually judge the thing here.
Yeah. My only comment to Ben is I think I would have preferred if this was a little more focused. I mean, it's just adventures, and it's for a variety of stuff. I think I would have preferred if you maybe just did one for the One Savage World Kickstarter. I think that might confuse some people.
Yeah, do one, do it fast, do it hard, do it for one location, see where the market is, and then use that as an idea how to focus your company, because I'll admit it, I think I suffer from severe gamer ADD. I love adventures and modules. I'll write all sorts of crazy stuff. But ultimately, you got to focus on one thing at a time.
So, but I mean, the good news, like you said, that at least they have something already published. You can check that out.
Yeah, I'd say even if you don't support the Kickstarter, if you're a Savage World fan, try out their thing and see if it's worth a darn. And then if they're asking us for help, give them constructive feedback.
And so I think that's the end of the episode. Anything, any closing comments for you? I have none.
Well, all I can say is it was a graveyard smash.
Horrible. You horrid.
I try.
All right, but obviously if you have a comment you want to send to us, you can obviously send us an email at info@rpgcircus.com. You can leave us a comment on our Facebook page or the website for the episode post. Leave a comment there. There's still the link to the SpeakPipe application, and so you can still send us a voicemail. Or you know what? You can just record something on your computer and send it to us in an email. We'd be more than happy to play that as well. Anything else, or can we just get the hell out of here?
I think we're good.
All right, then I think we're going to get the hell out of here and say we'll see everyone in about 2 weeks, and hopefully we'll have something a lot more interesting to talk about besides the monster. RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.